Hey guys, welcome to Pest Control Millionaire, the podcast where we dive deep into the world of pest control and talk industry experts who have turned their passion into profit. Join us as we interview successful entrepreneurs and share valuable insights and provide you with the strategies and inspiration you need to build your own very own multi-million dollar pest control empire. Parker, my guy, welcome to the podcast. For all of you that don't know who Parker is, he's a legend in the door-to-door space. And also, he's the guy who I have a ton of respect for. He came in, he taught me everything that he knew. He's actually the person who helped launch Turf Badger. But Parker Langeveld, he's actually the president of sales at Hawks Pest Control. He does a little consulting on the side, and he ended up in Green Bay, Appleton with us for a few weeks, and that's just how we got out the ground. So I want to say thanks for being with us, Parker, today. I appreciate you, all the knowledge that you bring, not just to me, but to the entire industry. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me out, man.
Yeah, you guys who don't know him, you guys are about to get your heads blown away. Probably one of the smartest guys I've ever met in person. He's definitely in the top five for sure. A good friend of mine, and made a massive impact to the industry. Parker, why don't you first tell us just like how you got started in the industry? Take us way back.
Okay. I'm a member of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. I served a mission full-time in Chile, knocking doors. Came home, and I was always fascinated with human body. I was a skinny kid until I was a junior in high school. And when I was a junior in high school, we got a new football coach. Ours was so bad that for 2 years in a row, we didn't win a single game. So new coach came in and wanted us to train hard and brought an element of CrossFit to it. And I became obsessed super quick. Enough that was literally my life and my passion in high school going into senior year. I put on like 40 pounds, ended up getting super strong, got introduced to a powerlifting gym by a mutual friend. And I went out there and felt super cool that I was deadlifting 550 pounds and a guy pulls 800 in front of me. And I'm like, all right, how do you know that was humanly possible? We got a long way to go. So from there, you know, biology, physiology, biochemistry became a huge passion of mine to see what a diet did in the human body, what supplementation did in the human body. And so I was convinced, I was always really good. I was smart. I was on a full ride scholarship when I got home from my mission to the University of Utah. Took 21 credit hours my first semester, was double majoring. And I had an internship lined up to go work in the pharmaceutical labs of Bayer. And that's where I thought I was going to go. A mentor of mine was Scott Wilson that owns Hawks. He had reached out to me, said, "Hey, bro, got a job for you. You should come hear about it." So, you know, I was never one. I've never been one to close a door. I believe that until you're 40, you need to say yes to most opportunities. And once you've already made it, now you can be a little bit more selective on saying no. So I went in, sat down with him, and first thing out of his mouth was, "Hey, bro, this is door to door." And I kind of chuckled. I had no idea what door to door was. I didn't have a background with it, even though I was from Utah. Wasn't from Provo All-Star area. I was up north more in Ogden is what my town's called. And so I'm like, dude, no shot. I just went door-to-door for 2 years in Chile. I'm not going door-to-door again here. He's like, "Well, look, check out these numbers. The average guy can make like 30 grand in a summer." And I was this young, naive kid that had just had the church paying for me for 2 years straight. I got a couple $100 a month in Chile, which was plenty to live off of. And I was on a full ride scholarship, still lived at home, didn't have much overhead costs. And so I was like, bro, I don't care. Don't need the money, not going to sacrifice making $350,000 as a doctor to make 30 grand now. Didn't realize the impact that student debt would have, any of the above. Like, it just, that was my attitude to it. However, Jonas, I had one pretty poignant why at that point in my life. The mentor I looked up to most was my mission president. He's since passed away from cancer, but his name was Lathor Bluth. He's from Phoenix Valley and started a company called Western Eye that they did, you know, eye surgeries. And what fascinated me is for 2 years I got to see in hard scenarios when you teach, you know, the gospel to individuals and you're asking them to make significant life changes that impact everything about their life, their social circle, their lifestyle. It's hard for them to make said changes. And I saw him accomplish in 30 minutes what it took some of us that were 19, 20 weeks to do. And what I mean by that is, like, he would interact with people and their wall would just drop, like, overnight. It didn't take this runway of building a relationship. Like, individuals just immediately trusted him. And all I could chalk it up to at that point in time was this idea of empathy. When he talked, it was different than when we talked, because it wasn't like he was regurgitating what he knew or what he read or what lived in his head, like what he talked about was based on experiences he'd had. He was 60 years old and he was further along in life, but you could tell that he was a student of the game until that point in life. And so I wanted to be like that. I wanted to have the superpower of empathy, of being able to actually impact people, that when I spoke, it was based out of my experience. And the fastest way to chalk that up, I decided, was travel. But not travel like, I want to go see Dubai. I want to go stay in a 5-star hotel. Want to do cool vacations. It was, I want to go see the culture of the world, why people think the way they think, what impacts them, informs, you know, who their character is and who they are. So I asked in this meeting kind of haughtily, I was like, look, dude, where are you guys going? The owner was like, oh, we're going to Texas. And immediately I'm like, all right, where's the contract I'll sign? Like, seriously, flipped on a dime in that meeting. He starts laughing. He's like, what in the world? And I'm like, look, dude, I don't really think that what I do this summer for 3 months, whether I make a bunch of money or not, is going to impact me a ton. But my why right now is empathy and travel, and I'm going to stay congruent to that. Like, I like the opportunity of going to Texas. I've never been there. I like the idea of meeting a ton of people and finding out why they think the way they think. I think it'll help me mature way quicker as a 20-year-old and get to where I want to go in life. So that was really my landing point and my starting point way back when, is, you know, fine, I'll go sell, see if I'm any good. The company was way smaller. There wasn't a ton of training in place. The industry was way different. They counted accounts back then and not revenue. And if you sold a 550 contract, that was huge, man. Like, that, people were selling 400s and 450s. But that was my starting ground and my landing point of what made me decide, okay, cool, you know, let's go out and rock and roll with this. That was way back in 2017.
Yeah, and you hit the ground running fast. Obviously, most people know that. But your first year on the doors, what was your revenue that you did that year?
Just over 400K, which at the time was a record for rookies. It's since been beat. Folks are always raising the bar. But back then, that was the biggest that there was. It was just over 600 accounts as a rookie that I was able to toss down.
I don't want to jump ahead of myself, but what made you different? Why were you able to hit those big numbers? Like, what's the difference between the top 1%er and just the average guy? Is it mindset or is it skill? And is that skill, can that skill be learned?
I think that there's a plague going around nowadays where everyone says, just work hard enough and you'll have it. Unfortunately, I don't know if the podcasters will know who this is, but no matter how much I want to be Bjørn Hafþórsson, never going to be Bjørn Hafþórsson. I'm not the mountain. I'm not going to go deadlift 1,100 pounds. Like, right. It's just, I don't have that physiology. So, look, I'm a believer that everybody enters this game at a certain talent level, and that talent is a natural level. You can just do what you do without knowing why you do it. But on top of that, now if you want to become a top 1%er like you're talking about, it takes building skill on top of talent. And how wide that chasm is, frankly, depends on who you are. The sales game, Jonas, was never really a super difficult one for me to figure out. I feel like I've always been naturally talented with sales. Now, my barrier, when I first entered, I was doing 5 a day. Halfway through the summer, I was able to build that into 7 a day. And by the end of the summer, I could hit 12. Okay. Now I can go out and throw down 20 to 25. So yes, you can build skill on top, or talent on top of that skill, but my barrier was always more around recruiting later on in my story. That was really difficult for me to learn that game. I wasn't as natural there. But, you know, to answer your question holistically on what made me different the first summer, I really just think it came back down to my why. I found when I counted the money, I sold worse. Okay. It was never really about the money. The advice that was given to me at that age was this: your life is a story. Every chapter counts, and you can only write it once. And I just recognized, like, okay, look, I'm 20 years old, likely not getting the best deal out there. There's probably people that have done this 5 years that got better commission than I did. I didn't care. Likely, probably may or may not be my career at the end of the day. Again, didn't care. Why? Well, I just come out of a two-year experience that there's really no way to put your thumb on, but it's like this microcosm of life in life. And here's what I saw. You know, you come home and in the Utah LDS culture, people are like, oh my gosh, you served a mission. But I saw that, like, there's a wide variety of missionaries that went out, Jonas. There was a wide variety about how hard they worked, how serious they took it, how effective they were. And you don't know that unless you were there. But what I saw is those that went out there and really gave their all for 2 years and really bloomed where they were planted opened up an opportunity for themselves that didn't happen for the others. And so that was my thing. I'm 20. There's probably a lot more I don't know than what I do know. But if I just bloom where I'm planted here, it'll probably open up way more doors later on. So that when I know more than I know now, I can walk through those. Versus if I just kind of sit here and count the money or have a low-level 20-year-old mindset, I'm going to close doors that could have opened 10 years from now that I don't even know about yet. And that was my attitude all summer.
Yeah, I remember you telling me back in the day, like, you wouldn't even look at your bank account.
No.
During the summer. You didn't want to get distracted because it wasn't about the money. You knew it was going to be there.
No, I didn't even have the money go to my account. It went to my dad's because I understood that I didn't know how to budget. 20 years old. You go put 200 grand in my bank account, I'm going to blow it. I don't know what to do with it. So I'm like, okay, cool, put a barrier up, have my dad help me. But yeah, that was never what it was about.
Right. So then how do you go from first year rep to the president of sales at one of the largest pest control companies in the country?
Oh, it's been a journey. I mean,
yeah, I've been part of it for the last couple of years. Not all great, right?
Well, there's ups and downs. So after that first summer, came back and I ended up bringing my best friend. His name's Parker Wilson, out with me my first summer. And the owner's like, cool, now you got to go recruit. Right. And I'm like, well, why would I go recruit? And he's like, well, you'll make more money, bro. I made $200,000 as a 20-year-old. I don't even know what to do with that money. Like, I'm not going to go buy a Range Rover. I don't need more money. But again, I just kind of fell back on, all right, fine. Like, do I have right now something in my face that would force me not to go recruit? Like, full-time in school doing this stuff, is there something there that I can't bloom where I'm planted? And the answer was no. And I also had somebody put at me, like, they're like, look, you want to be successful in life, you want to go be a doctor. The analogy they gave is that dentists are some of the best salesmen on the planet. Why? Well, everyone hates putting metal in their mouth, yet you go pay them anyway. And it's super competitive. So why do you pick one dentist over another? Well, it's because I like them, right? So they're like, look, you want to be successful at anything, you need three skill sets. Whatever, you need to be an expert in whatever technicality you want to go into. Doctor, dentist, whatever it is. Second, you need to sell and recruit. So I'm like, all right, fine. I guess I understand the value of that. I got to figure out how to recruit, okay, if I want to be successful. So the next 3 months, that's what I did. Somebody convinced me that it'd be a good idea to buy a 3 Series BMW. So I did that. Retrospectively, it means nothing. Don't buy a fancy car to recruit. But I did. I put 30,000 miles on it in 3 months, ran a ton of meetings, and I signed zero freaking people. No one. And without getting too far in the weeds on the answer, because we're limited on time, I came 3 months later, came across a lot of Simon Sinek's material and understood that I was selling a lot of what's and how's and not a lot of why. And I lost the same intentionality as why I went out there on the doors in the summer. I was able to bring that back in and decided to, you know, I wanted to quit 3 months in. And I was always like 1 foot in, 1 foot out, where it was like, dude, I'm good enough at sales that I can go make 200, 300,000 in a summer. Save it, put some stuff in the real estate on the side, and do I really need to learn how to recruit? But my why that summer kind of metamorphosized, and it became more than just gaining empathy. It became that I was an agent that acts and not an object that was acted upon, and I quit because I decided to quit, not because something beat me. That was it. I'm like, well, if I walk from recruiting right now, it beat me. Can't do it. I may hate it. I may never want to do it, but I'm going to figure it out so that when I quit, I'm like, I'm quitting because I don't want to do it, not because I can't. So anyway, ran across some of Sinek's stuff, and the next 3 months ended up recruiting 55 people. Brought them out, went out for the summer back to Dallas. Had a mental block in my head at the time that the only place I could sell well was Dallas because that's where I was as a rookie, and that's the immature mindset, is it's not me, it's the market. So I felt some comfort going back to the first year's market. We went out there. Everyone hit the floor. We had a phenomenal team preseason. Ended up being told by some guys that had done it for a long time, it was one of the best trained teams they'd ever seen up to that point in time. And we sucked. We went out for the summer and absolutely got railroaded, dude. I had done a number of things wrong. I told people that if they couldn't sell 300 accounts, then they sucked and may as well quit. And now if you've done this job for a bit, you know that if you go do 300 deals as a rookie, that's well above average. They did great. But in my mind, I'm like, well, if I did 600, you can't do half that, then you must be half-assing it. So I had created a platform automatically over-promising, under-delivering that I didn't know. And I had mentors tell me not to do it. They're like, bro, at the time I had a young, ambitious mindset that I'm like, all you're trying to do is get me to set the bar lower. Stop trying to tell me I can't do something that hasn't been done before, without understanding that there's some wisdom that goes into that whole analogy. So I sent it, young ambition. That was wrong. We had a bunch of stuff go wrong with operations that year that I realized that anything that could go wrong would. I built my success around if everything went right, we would do well. And now that I've done this longer, I realize if everything goes wrong, can you still succeed? Because that's what happens. And then I had a narcissistic relationship with a fiance at the time that didn't end up helping things out. So after the end of that summer, I still sold well. I only knocked 2 or 3 hours a day and still sold 600 accounts that summer. And in my mind, that was my other thing. My gosh, I have so much going on with, you know, managing the relationship with operations and managing in the back scenes that I need to lead from the front. So as long as I'm selling more accounts than the rest of my team, then they can't say anything and I am leading from the front. So I was on the top of the leaderboard every day, but it didn't work because they're like, well, you're not knocking the hours we knock. And that's when I realized, like, as a leader, I have to do everything they're doing plus my stuff. It can't come at the cost of the other. And it's both the performance and the routine I must lead from the front end. So anyway, all those lessons learned came back, dude, and I lost everyone but three dudes. Okay, 55 whittled down to three, and now I was at this next barrier that it's like, bro, I'm gonna quit. This just isn't for me. Recruiting again smashed me in the face. Had to learn that skill, and now management was kicking my butt. And there was this decision to be made. Like, am I gonna go here and recede back and say, well, maybe something different for me, or was I gonna attack it head on? And again, that same analogy came up. Like, bro, I'm an agent that acts, not an object that gets acted upon. I'm not going to quit when I'm down. I can't do it because I know a loss will lead another loss. So I came back at it. And we brought a smaller team out. We brought 21 guys out to Houston, and I opened the market for Houston the next year, the market for the company. And that year, I had finally committed to hitting a golden door. Well, why did I commit? Frankly, Jonas, I knew I could have hit a golden door to year one and year two. I did 600 accounts as a rookie and didn't knock anything in August. I stopped because I couldn't even get out of bed. I was so depressed. I had my blackout curtain shut over me, and I'm like, didn't know how to manage my emotions and fell into stupid vices. So 2 years later now, going into opening Houston, I had spent a lot of time working with a therapist on how to manage my own emotions, and that was always my barrier. It was never, I need to go train more on sales. I need to go pick somebody's brain. It was always, can I keep myself from getting in my own way? And that was the commitment that summer, right? So that's what happened. We went out, took 21 guys out to Houston, opened a new market. There was a bit of nerves now because, again, there was that little bit of barrier, like, was it Dallas? And I went out, and I remember my first week, I opened up the gates with 78 deals serviced. And I ended up doing, in 62 selling days that I actually went out and knocked, I did 1,015 accounts. And we ran a PRA that summer with 290-plus accounts. I trained Connor Hill, my rookie that's now absolutely gone on and crushed it, hit a golden door, slaughtering it in solar. He broke my rookie record. And, you know, that was really the turning point. When I came home, now 2 years of getting smashed in the face, working on all my off-pissed PISTE stuff that wouldn't do with work, I started to realize, like, the man is holistic. Everything outside of work was what was preventing me from reaching my potential at work. So 2 years in the making of putting that all down. Well, then I podcasted with Taggart on D2D Experts, opened up to him about, hey, some of these vices are, you know, the reason I don't have social media and since haven't, and I had to work on this. Talked about, you know, how the team would perform. And then Hawks gave me kind of another punch to the face. There was a change in the pest control industry. You know, all of a sudden you have the Altera deal that went down. And chains, the multiples companies got bought for because that went south. You started to realize that the door-to-door accounts were viewed and retained differently than your organic growth over a long period of time. And we were all sitting there, GreenX, Aptiv, Hawks, Vantage, playing Game of Thrones with each other, tossing out deals, playing the MD game, gutting each other, pathway to growth, go get the big multiple, sell the accounts, flip it, and then it's like, wait, this isn't going to work. Private equity enters into the scene and now doesn't want you to look like a door-to-door company anymore. So Hawks pulls way back on the freaking gas, goes from wanting to grow lights out to saying, hey, like, we only want to do 15,000 accounts. And I had gotten an offer to kind of be Hawks' chief training officer. This is the year after Houston, where they wanted me to kind of help duplicate what happened on that team with other teams. I went out and sold for a week. That's the week that, you know, secretly – I said, and it wasn't secretly, it was internally as a company, but I'm like, I'm going to go do 120 accounts serviced in a week because no one had done that. It was 20 a day. But he's like, oh, you have a few 20 days in the summer. And so I went out, scared the daylights out of me. It was a big enough goal that I'm like, bro, this is wild. Went to Dallas to go work with a rookie team and knocked while I was out there. after the first day, I had done 24 deals by 6:30 in the afternoon. And I stopped. I knocked in wingtips and dress pants, stopped and started spraying the accounts so my text didn't fall behind and could help me same day. Then I got a call that night from O'Donnell, Mike O'Donnell, that's like a goat, the legend in solar. He's like, bro, you're going for the record in pest? And then the anxiety doubled because somehow O'Donnell and Taggart have found out. They told everyone. And I'm telling you, dude, I've learned over the period of time that anyone that's boisterous and loud with a goal they hit probably won't hit it. The dudes that are really going after a big goal, there's this element of quiet confidence. You know, put my money where my mouth is and you find out after the fact. And now I'm like, crap, well, pressure's on. So I ended up doing it. I ended up doing 130 serviced in a week that year instead of 120. Came back and jumped on another podcast with Taggart. And that's when I talked about this idea that everybody just says work harder, but you can only rev an engine so hard, like put a bigger engine in there to get better. We did a whole podcast on that and what that looked like. Well, that combination, that meeting led to Sam offering me a job to come consult, which is something that was on my bucket list that I really wanted to do. Simultaneously stacked up with what was going on with the door-to-door space with Pest. And I just realized, like, okay, man, at this point in life, there's two things at Hawks. One, they need to go another direction that isn't relying on door-to-door, and my job growth and opportunity is relying on door-to-door. They want to keep just enough so that they can start doing things with their EBITDA and their LTV and to poise for a buy from private equity. Second is those guys were mid-30s. They had three kids. I had just broken up with a fiance of 2 years. I had no family, no kids. So they wanted to work 40 hours, 50 hours a week, whatever was necessary, and then go spend time with their family. I wanted to work 90 hours a week, travel, and be involved in that world. So I understood that our wives had kind of separated. I ended up taking a job with Sam Taggart, and we started consulting. And I remember he looked me in the eyes when we first started consulting and told me there's no money in pest control. He wanted me to jump into solar. He's like, bro, you're not going to do it. And he also wanted the W to me. And he's like, here's a base, then you'll make commission on top. So I came back and I'm like, all right, if I'm going to do it, I'm not W-2'd. I'm 1099. I'll eat what I kill. I'll bring clients to the table. Okay. We can do a rev share split, but I'm going to keep most of it and I'll bring my own clients. I don't need you to give me people. So he's like, okay. And I'm like, and I'm going to do pest. Well, a few months later, the average expert over there, the consultant took five, maybe six clients. I had 17, most of them self-poached and self-found, you know. You were one of them that we were working with at the time, and I was traveling 28 days a month. It was asinine, the schedule. It was exactly what I wanted. But then in that point in my life, you know, I met a new girl that I is now my current wife, and I was gone from her, Ellie, 28 days a month. So things started to kind of metamorphosize. Ended up not loving the situation with who I was working with over at DDD Experts. So branched out there. And that was at that point in my career, three things kind of popped up. One, there was five smaller solar companies that wanted to merge to a big one out in California, which became True Power. Brandon Hall went out there to be the CEO, wanted me to go be the chief sales officer. So I lived in Temecula that summer for a few months doing solar and traveling like crazy for consulting. Then we started our own consulting company called Shut the Fluff Up. Me, Brandon, and Alex went out and founded that and have, you know, done great there. And then while I was entertaining the idea of going and being CSO at True, that's when Hawks got bought by Mike Paulus. That was wild. What Mike wanted to do, came in and was like, dude, we're not going to operate out of a box. I want door to door to go as big as possible. And so I was entertaining a few different interviews and job offers. And they wanted me to come back over. I wasn't going to be president of sales off the rip at Hawks. They wanted me to come over as a regional and bring my network. So, you know, after a long period of time, that's where I decided to go. But Mike was like, I want you to take the company from 111 sales reps to 1,000 in a year. Like, who does that? Who does that, Mike? There's no way, dude. 1,000 guys in one freaking year. Like, Grit had done that out in the space, but they merged freaking John, Ben, Garth, John. It took four regionals rolled into one to go do that kind of volume. I'm like, dude, what are we going to do here? So I ended up coming over, taking that job. My wife and I felt good about that. And long story short, we did it. We poached six regionals in 1 year from other companies through my network. And we brought over 1,000 guys to the company in a year. So after that year, the downline had done $58 million in volume in its first year that I brought over. And then the company approached me and offered me president of sales and wanted me to have an equitable stake with them. And that's kind of what I've been operating out of ever since is, you know, president of sales. And we're building another vertical that's now a hot lead vertical with insulation and termite. And they're asking me to attack heavy this year. But, you know, that's the backstory of how one thing kind of led to another throughout my career, dude. It's, like I said, doors opened that I never would have known by blooming where I was planted when I was younger and dumber.
Yeah, it's a hell of a story for sure. And going back to the Sam Taggart thing, you know, where we connected, I heard you, it was a like a call that you were doing or training, I think. I heard it and I was like, hey, dude, can I reach out to you? And you're like, heck yeah, you. So here's my number. And then we jumped on a phone call like that same day and you talked to me for like an hour for free, just giving me information. I think a week later, I think if I remember correctly, we were your first coaching client, I think.
Yep. That's when I flew out up there to Appleton. We went and knocked in October.
We did. And it's like, it's a funny story. Cause like, you're like, man, I don't even know if I could do this anymore. It's been a while. And 45 minutes later, you have 8 accounts. We're like, I think you can still do it. But going back to that, when I was talking about it, like we were so fresh at the time, we didn't have contracts in place. Remember, you're like, wait, you guys didn't have a contract? We're like, no, like we didn't know what the hell we're doing. Like, so just going back like from day one and then to what we've built today, like, is pretty incredible. Just because, again, we had you for the first year of our career, like starting door knocking. We had one of the best in the entire industry teach us how to do it. And we had your training, we had your growth experience, like we had it all there. And that was really the catalyst for what we built here. So like, just going back to like, remember like days one, like Parker just shows up. She's like, first thing we do is we sprint to the doors, you know? And it was fun. And I learned a lot that summer. We didn't know anything. Like we were even pretty new to the pest control game at that point. So it was tucked away in hotel. Grinding for like three straight days, just information. We were pitching each other our first pitch, like in front of you, like trying to figure it out. And yeah, it's a pretty wild story where it came from. And I remember you coming in, just like, I remember like after like your first year, I told you that at someday I was going to do the Pest Control Millionaire podcast. I told you back then, 5 years ago, that I was going to do it. I remember, I think you were here and I bought the domain while you were here. I'm like, I'm just going to do it someday. And so then fast forward, you know, 4 years later, launch podcast. We're like 75, 76 episodes in. We do one a week. And now here we are talking on the podcast. It's just pretty surreal to see the story of like how it started.
That's awesome, bro.
I didn't know how I was going to do it. I just knew that I could do it because you told me that I could. You're like, man, you have a great market. Like you're a sharp kid, but I never was one to talk a lot, right? Like, I always sit there and listen. And I talk a ton. I was like the guy in the back room, just a little bit older, but listening, taking notes, listening, learning, and just to go put it all into place has been pretty awesome.
I remember that. You took notes like a madman on everything.
Yeah. And so like, and then once you said go, it was all in, you know?
Yep.
So now we, you know, we're built multiple offices, we have regionals, like, but you laid it out for us. Like, here's the roadmap. We just follow this roadmap. And that's what we did. But I had some questions that I had written down, but you answered a lot of them through your story. The CEO that came in, was it 2 years ago?
So he's not the CEO. Scott Wilson is still the CEO. He's the executive chairman that owns the majority of the company. Yeah, that's Mike Paulus.
So he brought in some capital, right, to push the thing forward?
Yep.
And how many offices did you guys add at that year? Because I remember it was a lot.
Like 17.
17 offices?
Yeah, it was wild. There was a bunch of new ones.
Yeah, and although it sounds like it is a lot, it's not easy. What were some of the biggest challenges that you faced during that period of time that we could learn from?
Yeah, no, it's a great question. I mean, first and foremost, I saw scenarios recruiting where it would have been extremely easy to overpromise, underdeliver, and create issues. Okay. I think there are lessons learned on each skill ties into the next. How you sell directly impacts your ability to recruit. How you recruit directly impacts your ability to manage. They're not compartmentalized boxes. You have to really start with the end in mind. We had an opportunity for a poll this last year where there was an individual that was a big hitter that wanted to come from another company. And the manager that was recruiting him, I made sure to be very intentional. I sat down with him and I'm like, look, make sure that he knows exactly why he's switching, and that why adds up to coming to Hawks. Meaning, you start to realize when you sell that there's not a one-size-fits-all. There's differences, right? Like, is a Jeep or a Corvette a better vehicle? Well, they're completely different. They're different for better things, right? It's the same thing in each company. A company has a niche, and you need to figure out, like, where do I want to go? What's the niche I want to project out into the world or the ether cloud, and then bring them in for that. And I'm like, make sure his why matches up with where we're at, where you can take him at this current phase in business. And I think that was probably the first challenge that I would say is, you know, monitoring recruiters to not apply a we're better, one size fits all, come over here for this. Like, you're better for who? Some individuals, and you're worse for others. And I think that we've adopted over the years this idea of just recruit everyone and everyone and say that it's the best situation for them. And if you want to build the longevity of a program, I always tell guys it's easy to – not easy, but it's a lot harder to make $1 million year over year than it is to get to $1 million in the first place. It's a lot harder to maintain 1,000 guys than it is to get 1,000 guys, right? And that, I'm telling you, is your ability to build around a person and understand, like, where are you at of this phase in life? This is where we're at. Where does your phase want to go? Can I truly offer you a better situation or not? So that was probably lesson one. Lesson two with rapid growth is it's brutal to keep up on the operational side. You put on that much volume to try to scale that many technicians in the market with new startups that quick. Relatively, if you look back over what Hawks was able to do, cancellations or not, it was pretty good what we were able to get done that year and retain account-wise. But, man, you just start to realize that if you're not 1099 and door-to-door, the rest of the working world operates at a much slower pace than you do. They're not taking 11 p.m. calls. They're not doing 6 a.m. calls. And that's why they're not making the kind of money that you can sit there and make, right? But you have to learn to work together. When you want to go accomplish something at that scale, there's a lot of departments that touch each other. Retention, operations, marketing, finance, compliancy, HR, like it all weaves in. And so you have to be really, really on the ball as a leader in your sales organization to understand, okay, how do we set up a system where we're all intertwining instead of this vertical works at the cost of the rest of these? So, you know, that was a huge lesson learned. The other lesson to be learned is private equity brings a lot to the table, Jonas. Anyone that's listening that wants to be involved with that, like, you understand that if you say you're going to do something, then you better go do it, or there's going to be some repercussions and some consequences. If I say I'm going to do this much volume and I don't, you know, they'll figure out a way. They drive hard. And I've never, even with that whole backstory I told you, I'd never experienced that the way I have now these past 2 years of the way those guys work. And they ask you to do the impossible and then you feel good about hitting it. And there's not really even a pat on the back. It's like, cool, now go do it again and up it. Those were some massive lessons that we learned on that level. I think the last one that is relevant to that I'll talk about that's relevant to a sales leader is this. More than ever, I've learned that your ability to retain your downline is your ability to mature with your downline. It's not about what are your PRAs. It's not about just what type of money are you making overall. It's about, can the people I lead mature with me? Meaning, it starts, if I'm on the very lower, the beginning echelon of my story, well, their story is probably going to mimic a similar pattern. It starts as, can they go sell at a high level? And if you can, you added a value add to your story of why you can recruit a certain amount of people and why they'll retain with you, because they can learn from you and now they can learn to sell at a high level. Now, that only goes so far. It runs out at some point, right? And if I don't continue to expand beyond as a leader, then I'm going to lose my downline. They'll go look for value elsewhere because people don't want to stay stagnant. They want to mature. So now it's like, okay, can you recruit at a high level? And if you can do that, well, I just broaden my story and I just bought myself a few more years, because that's all it is with recruiting if you're doing it in an honest way. I see a lot in this industry where guys will indoctrinate their downline, and I've never been able to hop on board for that. I'm not going to pitch them some indoctrination and cultural buy-in that tattoo my company across your chest. The reason that I'm allowed to make money off you and the reason that I'm allowed to lead you is I'm just a few years ahead of you. And I'm gonna help you journey where I did faster and better because you follow me. But that means that I have to continue to stay a few years ahead of you. If I stay stagnant, now a few years pass, you're going to go to somebody else that does, because you can no longer mature and reach your stature. So after recruiting, it becomes management. Can you produce the way you're supposed to produce? After that, it becomes replication. Now, do you know how to train recruiting, sales, and management to duplicate that? And after you've done that, those are all the skills that I would say become necessary to reach regional stature. You want to be a regional? Okay, those are the four things you need to know how to do. When I'm now there and you want to go above that, though, now it becomes like, okay, for all these years we've pitched that if you come do door-to-door, you're going to live a better lifestyle. But are you actually? Or are you in a spot where you make so much money that you don't know how to budget, you spend it all, and you're like, ah, I'll just go make more? Do you know where your freaking credit's at? Do you know how to get home loans? Do you know how to have solid tax strategy? And that's what it then became at that point. Is it's like, I'm going to sit you down and show you how to get a high board of mentors, how to read contracts, how to understand the legalities of business, how to understand, you know, your investments. And now I'm allowed to continue to make money off you because I'm doing those things. And that's where Vivint got to. I've had an opportunity to chat with some of those presidents, and their leadership things got to a point where their sales guys were mature enough that their leadership conferences were no longer around pitches and sales training and recruiting. It was around, you know, the president of sales got up and talked about the five other companies he owned and K-1s and taxes and da 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 da. That's how you end up having 35-year-old managers still working with you, and everyone makes a shit ton more money because you matured the entire program, right? And that's the biggest lesson that we've learned getting to that size. And we've seen other companies that have lost significant downlines that we've been able to take because their maturation process just isn't there yet. I just recruited an $8 million downline by helping them understand that making $1 million K-1 is drastically better and different than making $1 million 1099 because the tax benefits applied to it, and understanding how does PES fit into that overarching picture for you then. So it becomes at that point, you're playing business within business. And that's probably the biggest lesson we've learned that allows us to continue to play ball and retain guys. Despite Jonas' challenges, when Mike first came in with Hawks, it was, let me give you FU money. Go out, spend money, recruit guys. And it was. Then a year down the pipe, it was, let me change that. Now I care about EBITDA when I didn't before. So guess what? That money's changing. Now can you do what you just did with less? And that was super challenging for a lot of leaders because they're like, holy crap, this was my why. It was all in front of me. And now it's like, yeah, but can you run an efficient machine? And you look back to the one company in this door-to-door space that's actually been able to go effectively IPO, and it was Vivint. And that's exactly what they did. They got bought by Goldman Sachs. Goldman Sachs tossed some FU money at them. Then Goldman Sachs tightened up the reins and said, great, cool. Now can you do both? Can you run an efficient P&L on the sales force? Okay. And I've talked to those presidents and they had to go back. I mean, there was years that Todd came to him, Jonas, and said, hey, we're going to cut the pay scale, figure out how to not lose guys. And he's like, bro, we felt some enmity towards Todd when he did that. Like it made us feel really bothered, but it was a necessary thing. And so they had to figure it out. They could no longer pitch Vivint. They had to pitch their region. They had to pitch their story. They had to pitch, I own five other businesses. Follow me. And they had to figure out how to do that in the sales force. They couldn't rely on Vivint to give them money anymore. Well, then guess what happened? Now they figured out how to scale and have the P&L they wanted. And then they got bought by Blackstone. And Blackstone put a war chest in front of them where they had a big old amount of money to go do sign-ons. And why? Well, that didn't affect the bottom line P&L. It was a one-time payment. And they were willing to do it because now they could scale and they could fit it within the right macroeconomics. And I remember hearing back in the day that the sign-on bonus, if you were a manager, was like $80,000 just to freaking go sign on with them because that's what Blackstone did. And then they went out and they took it public and all those guys made a ton of freaking money. Recently, we had the opportunity to talk to one of the original VPs who's like, bro, when we first sold to Goldman, if I would have cashed out my equity, I would have made $500,000. So I rolled it to Blackstone. And if I would have cashed out when Blackstone bought it, I would have made $2 million. And I rolled it again, and then I made $25 million. And that's the crazy thing. You hear all these guys nowadays being like, bro, I'm going to make $3 million a year. Yeah, you're not going to make $3 million a year, 1099 on a company's payroll. You start making that kind of money, they start looking at it, Jonas, and going, does that guy really need to make $3 million, or could he do the same thing for $800,000? The reason these guys made that much money is they figured out how to run the organization like a business. And that's the biggest challenge that's happened the past 18 months for us is understanding that sales is a subsidiary of business and they need to align. You have to get the business a win in order for you to win. And I just see in the industry at that scale that those sales guys start to think, I want to win at the cost of a business and they're never going to duplicate what happened there if you don't figure that out. And that's been the refiner's fire to us over the last 18.
What's your thoughts on private equity then?
You're going to learn a ton. They're not your friends. Private equity exists so that private equity can get a win. But if you know how to do it the right way and dot your I's and cross your T's, then you're going to happen to be able to get a huge win yourself to then go out and play business at a level that you couldn't have before. They know exactly what they're doing. They throw a ton of money at stuff. They improve all the departments 1,000-fold. They bring in more departments than you knew needed to exist as a business. They want compliancy top-notch, and they don't want it to impact performance at all. So if you can play ball and stay in that squeeze, per se, you're going to leave being able to be super equipped to play business, not just sales. But that's what they're going to challenge you to do is can you add the skill set of business on top of salesmanship?
Yeah, so you and I have both seen many companies go private equity the last 3 to 5 years. Within a month, 6 months, a year, those CEOs are gone. And then you ask them, do you wish you would have done it? They're like, no, never. Why do you think?
Because you lose a lot of control. I mean, an LLC is the most flexible form of ownership that exists, right? Meaning like whoever the main owner is can write in way more rules into favoring him than you can if you were a corporation, and they do that. But private equity will put their thumb on you, and you have to play ball to make it happen. And I just don't think that the CEO or the executives are used to being under reporting to someone like that type of freaking pressure, that type of scenario where you just can't ask for a favor. You have to create a win-win for the private equity every single freaking time. And I think that's why they end up leaving. I think private equity with door-to-door is a little bit of a niche, Jonas, meaning like, look, it's hard to find a CEO that's excellent at door-to-door. Right? Like, I think that you have intrinsic value because if you are an excellent executive at our door-to-door space, you're rare to find. Private equity doesn't know how to play ball in door-to-door the same way. But you want to talk about some of these CEOs without mentioning names. I think that they bought into door-to-door like it has the bad namesake of doing, Wolf of Wall Street style. And private equity doesn't stand for that. They're going to come in an instant and say, do all your shit compliant or you're out. And they will weed you the freak out. Why? Well, Vivint just got freaking, it's public information. They had almost a 9-figure lawsuit settlement for that type of crap. And I think that that's why you see a lot of CEOs get sent down river is that they've just been able to, you know, play ball in a deregulated industry. And the moment regulations come down on you, it's like, well, you're not equipped to run both in the same pot.
Yeah. And so which brings me to the next thing. So a lot of the states are changing. Your sales guys have to be W-2'd over 1099. Have you ran into that? And how are you guys going to solve that?
Yep, it's a great question. And yes, Florida's that way. Carolinas are trying to push for that way. Not only that, but all of our guys have to be licensed as a technician to go sell in states.
I heard that too. Yep.
So we have a lot of barriers to jump through at that. And the first challenge in something like that is that the sales guys push back. If my guys want to go sell in Georgia, they have to go get 70 hours of field training that they're not getting paid on. So they're like, what the? And it becomes, again, you have to get them to look beyond just sales, and you have to get them to look into the business aspect of it and then get them to buy in, understanding that. And that was the first challenge. Second, when you talk about how are we going to do that with being W-2'd, there's still some ways that you can set it up where you can W-2 them on upfront and 1099 them on a back end, which is kind of a model and a system that we have set up. But like Florida, for example, if I want to have a guy do termite there, now that we're building that program, not only does he need to be W-2, but he needs a Florida driver's license. So now you have to know and come way more in. Like, we found a way to be able to help that happen because they can be treated as an independent contractor or a marketing company on their LLC. Their LLC can file for foreign corp or be based out of Florida, and then they can file for LLC taxes and S-Corp W-2 themselves through their company and have themselves get a driver's license through their own company and have the right licensure and then remain 1099 except for minimum wage on the upfront W-2. And now Hawks is completely legal and compliant with the state. But to try to go approach a sales guy and tell him I'll do that, I better have the legal connections, I better have the CPA connections, and I better have the knowledge to walk him through that and dot my I's and cross my T's.
What do you think? Do you like it or do you not like it? Do you think that it levels the playing field? And do you think that it brings a higher level person to sales, having to know the service side and the sales side and be licensed in both?
I don't mind the licensure. Yeah, I think that's fine. I think the sales guys should know that stuff too, so that they can know what's going on. 100%. The W-2 side to me is stupid.
Do you think it's just more of a tax play, right?
Yeah, I think companies are setting that up, or states are setting that up to create a barrier so that you can't come in there and steal work out of their state. That's precisely. I mean, the most strict state is California.
Yeah.
And the test in California literally existed as a lobbyist play to stop, I mean, by big companies like an Orkin to prevent smaller companies coming in and grabbing market share in that market. And it's so crazy in California that if you go take that test, it's 120 questions, Jonas, and too many people pass it the first time, they make it harder. Right? So I think that there's a lot of plays like that where, without getting too deep into politics, I think our government's becoming more and more freaking restrictive. And I'm not a fan of that.
Gotcha. What does the president of sales at Hawks look like on a day-to-day? What do you do day in and day out?
If you take recruits and you divide them into like a card stack, twos all the way up to aces, I'll take recruiting meetings with jacks and above. I'm involved on big polls like that.
That usually have an element
of legal to it, that have an element of, you know, 8-miling it and keeping things tight with their downline when there's a lot of variables. So that takes up a good chunk of my time. I oversee kind of all of the training aspect on the sales side, both for productivity and compliance. I also am involved in the policies of door-to-door, meaning what are fireable offenses, what does pricing look like, what does the service protocol look like, how do we streamline our onboarding process? What types of licensure are we going to do or not do? And then take that and make sure that I'm communicating with the other verticals in the company, the other departments, and that it becomes an intrinsic system that works for the whole company and not just sales. I also do a lot of leadership development in that role with our regionals and our VPs, helping them have high-level conversations, getting our leadership to mature and level up. And not just from a sales standpoint, but like budgeting standpoint. I'll break down budgets with my guys and be like, bro, why are you spending this much money? Let's freaking get your bucket here and let's put some money towards this. Do you understand how home loans work? Why are you doing this 4 years and you still rent? Why don't you buy a house and do some stuff for your credit? So a lot of that involvement. Then I've been tasked pretty heavily with opening up other verticals outside of door-to-door that drive more cash flow to the company year one, to kind of offset some of that debt you on take from door to door.
So that's what you're talking about, the termites, right? Termite insulation.
Yeah, termite insulation, exclusionary works, and stuff we want to do with home efficiency. That takes up a bunch of my time. And then I become the point of contact. I actually get more calls recently from other departments than my own guys asking me, hey, like, what's the SOP for this with sales? When we run into this, can you put that on a document and put that on our Hawks Hub and driving awareness? Like the director of our cancellation department, I've gone in there and trained them on, here's what's being said by our door-to-door guys on the doors. Here are the variables so that you can more effectively save accounts. Like, I get pulled across departments way more than I used to. That's what keeps me really busy.
Yeah. And how important is that role in itself, the cancellations?
Yeah, I mean, super, super important, because our guys expect high retention. And if the bigger you get, the less that departments talk and the less that you have a pulse on everything that's going on and the less you know all the employees. So you have to have really tactful SOPs, and they have to be written down in an area that are easy to access for, you know, your normal W-2 employees. And so I think that's invaluable to be able to chat amongst leaders like that.
Age old question, sales versus recruiting, what would you rather be better at?
I don't think that you can really separate the two. I mean, frankly, if I had to pick one of the two, I'd put sales over recruiting, only for this. I think if you're a good recruiter and can't sell well, it becomes really hard for you to maintain margin and create value for your guys. Like, you end up becoming a middleman of sorts, because I'm telling them to come do something that I can't help them succeed at, frankly. And then as a result, I don't really have the ability to wave my flag in the air and say, I'm your boss and I'm your upline. I have to approach it from a way that I have a hookup, and now I'm going to take a rip as a middleman. Whereas if I'm really good at sales plus recruiting, there's no problem with me saying I'm in your upline because I'm able to help duplicate something that I otherwise couldn't, and there's a reason I'm your leader. But if I am good at sales and not recruiting, I know I can go make 500 grand a year, 300 grand a year, and go dump that into, you know, assets that I grab and get my passive income to come up that has intrinsic value within itself. Nobody else can say, like, you don't deserve to make X.
Going back to your second summer, you were only knocking about 2 hours. You're on the phone, taking phone calls. Looking back at that, would you have done anything different?
Yeah. I mean, the biggest thing that I would have done is I would have understood that if I expected my guys to be on the doors from 10 to 9, then I needed to do the same. And I look at that with management now. I mean, we've divided management at that level into four levers, Jonas, that are you have to do all four of them at the same time. And if you don't, you have a huge problem. And those levers become, one, you need to lead from the front in both action and performance. So I can vet myself at any given time. Am I selling the best? And am I doing all the things that I ask them to do? Or am I asking them to do things that I'm not? And if that's the case, then I'm saying, do what I say, not do what I do. The second lever that we give becomes, you need to hold awareness on what your guys are actually doing on the doors. There's too much assumption. I see that on teams, that I assume they're struggling on the switchover, or I assume that because I trained on icebreakers, they're doing fine, but I don't have feedback loops built in from audio recordings and shadowing to say, now I train on that and it's not sticking. It's time to repeat. Like, I know what's actually happening. And then your morning meetings become irrelevant. Your training becomes irrelevant. And it's a huge problem. I think that if I'm a doctor and I prescribe before diagnosing, it's malpractice.
Yeah.
If I'm a surgeon and I just start cutting you open without knowing what's going on, I'm going to go to prison. Why is it then that if I'm a manager that second year, that I can go in and just give you sales advice without knowing where you're actually at? How many times do I see guys come in, Jonas, and go, well, I'm struggling with the spouse objection, and I listen to their recording and I'm like, you don't need help on the spouse objection. They're only saying that because they hate you. They don't like you. And you need to work on this. Your problem was 9 steps previous. So that becomes our second lever. Our third lever becomes, you need to hold awareness on your boy's certainty. And we use a tool called the certainty audit to do it. Certainty, it takes 3 things to sell at a high level or have a team produce at a high level. It takes, first and foremost, belief. Belief is that it's possible. If I'm at Turf Badger and nobody's throwing down high numbers, but I hear them doing it at other companies, I don't believe it's possible at Turf Badger. The moment somebody comes in and shatters that, okay, that now, oh my gosh, they did it in my market, I believe it's possible. Belief then trickles into certainty, and certainty is different from belief because certainty is, it's possible for me. Even though I just saw it, I may not believe it's possible for me yet. And then you run a certainty audit. There are 4 areas of certainty: the industry, the company, the team and systems, the service and pricing, and yourself. Frankly, if I believe that it's wrong to go out and, you know, if I have a serious girlfriend, then I'm not being faithful or a good freaking boyfriend to my girlfriend. Guess what, bro? I'm not going to sell at a high level. My certainty sucks. I believe that now the heavens won't bless me. So even though it's possible, it's not currently possible for me. So it's my job as a leader to hold certainty on my downline at any given time. That's my third lever. I don't need to raise it all the time, but I need to know where it is. I need to have a pulse without assuming. Then my fourth one is congregation. Are you consistently grouping up together and meeting? Because separation is deadly in this industry. And so the 4 things, those 4 levers become my 4 main points of focus that nothing else can come in and strip my focus or my eyesight from that. And if I tell you what I sucked at that second year when you asked, I didn't do lever 1. I did in production, but not time input. I didn't do lever 2 because I didn't spend the time shadowing my guys and listening to their audios to know what they actually were struggling at. So my morning meetings became my assumptions. I didn't do lever 3 where I didn't know good feedback loops to have in place to have a good certainty audit and know where they were. And then number 4, I halfway did, but I allowed there to be a big rift between my married guys and my single guys that created a big problem for me. So if I tell you what I would have done differently, honing in, thinking about it, well, right there, I would have hit those 3 levers knowing what I know now and knowing what I need to have in place that I frankly didn't do.
Yeah, and how often would you have your guys sending you voice recordings?
Well, now it's a policy that when I teach guys that it becomes a daily thing. You need to give me 2 voice recordings in my morning meeting. And I have a barrier of entry set up that somebody checks it and they check your date on that on the door. And if you don't have them, then 1, you're fined. And 2, you don't get to participate in my morning meeting that day. And if you miss too many morning meetings, you're gone. I fire you and you go home. Well, why? I forgot to do it. Well, I don't care. I'm not able to lead you effectively unless you get that for me. And so this is a minimum requirement to participate on this team. And why do I want two? Well, I'm not going to go in and deep dive on 2 times 20 every day. But what I am going to do is when I lay in bed at night, I'm going to sit and listen and high level scan through those and go, wow, that's a pattern. That's a trend. There's the pattern that you're struggling at. I'm going to take that to the morning meeting tomorrow and we're going to go train on that. And then I can actually see my morning meetings become effective on what we do.
Love that. I'm going to switch gears a little bit because we're out of time. If you had to jump back in the industry, let's just say you guys sell out, you're starting back over. What industry are you going in? Going solar, pest, HVAC, where are you going?
I think that pest overarchingly right now is doing better than solar. I think solar just took a massive hit because of NEM 3.0. I think that solar has been like the 08 housing market that's been deregulated for far too long and regulations are coming in. And the only way you're going to win is if you are set up to be a completely vertical company like a Sunrun. I think that's why they're making so many moves. If you hear about it in the industry right now, is because they're poised to make that happen, having done it the right way and being vertical. I think there's a massive play to be made in home efficiency, but I don't believe that's going to be a door-to-door play per se. Scaling that thing massively, I think that it has to be done the right way. I think there's regulations in place to access those rebates, but if I'm going to go play business, yeah, I'm super interested there. I think the two hottest door-to-doors right now is pest and actually fiber internet. Fiber internet's a big wave that's coming on that guys are starting to do that are paying big commissions, and it's a really good product for the consumer. I think that there's a lot of future there.
Yeah, and a lot of guys that listen to the podcast don't do a lot of door-to-door, but what are the pros and cons to door-to-door, and do you think that door-to-door can negatively impact your company?
Yeah, so you're asking me to highlight pros and cons from a rep level or an owner level?
Let's go owner level.
Okay, so from an owner level, I mean, here's the pro of door-to-door. Door-to-door is going to be your fastest growth mechanism. You're going to get more accounts door-to-door and more new customers than anywhere else. Here's the negative, is that it's not going to be a profit mechanism for very long. If you can stay out of the radar, you can keep your profit high at the beginning, but there reaches a threshold where you can't stay out of the radar. And the moment you come to the mountain with the rest of the companies, your profit gets blown out of the water. So at some point I start to view door-to-door as a way to acquire customers. And now if I'm savvy with business, I figure out a way to have other verticals set up to drive more dollar value and LTV out of those customers. Okay. The second aspect of door-to-door that's a con is that it's negatively viewed by the nation, by the consumer. People don't like somebody coming to their door. And it's really only the really high level guys that aren't going to drive negative reviews. A lot of your young guys, if they do it right and are ambitious, the majority of Hawks' negative reviews come from people that never signed up. They were just pissed off we knocked in their neighborhood. I think you're going to run into more and more regulations to get peddlers permits. They're making it harder and harder every year, and more communities are trying to opt into HOA. There's no soliciting allowed, which actually, frankly, is illegal. FYI, fun fact for you, Aptiv sued somebody in Florida for that, an HOA organization, and won. It's unconstitutional to make something non-soliciting because at an HOA level, you can't do that. Okay? So there's going to be a pushback, though, and a lot of people don't know that, and obviously homeowners don't like it. So from an ownership standpoint, I understand that it's going to negatively impact my PR. So I got to have mechanisms in place to positively drive my PR. Okay? Then the last thing that I would tell you is that super hard to maintain compliancy with door-to-door at scale. At a small level, I know. You want to get into multiple offices? You have no idea what your sales guys are saying. Really. I mean, you can try, but you best have practices and procedures and things in place because they're always going to push for less and less regulation. I mean, it is very deregulated compared to what you're used to, and you're going to have to figure out how do I put regulations on it whilst still allowing them to sell well at a high level and have the right leadership in place that it doesn't impact production. I think those are the biggest things that I would view and look at with door-to-door. In a pest control world or in a service industry, the last one is that naturally your LTV of consumer is less on door-to-door. You push the product on them they weren't looking for versus vice versa.
For sure, for sure. So when you sign them up at the door, going through the agreement, like you said, compliant, What's a great way right there to, or maybe a tip, a pro tip there on how to, because the customer always calls and say, oh, I didn't know it was I thought it was a one time. I didn't realize there's agreement, even though our reps go over it. Is there anything that you guys have done to improve that?
Yeah, I'll give you three biggies. One, you need to have a welcome letter in place. Okay, and that welcome letter, the most effective way to do that is if you have somebody in office that can call them and run them through it, great. If not, like right now, that would be too hard for us at our scale. So we have the rep do it and sign it. But we have a protocol in place that if it's not signed, what has to happen is that we send it to the customer's device. The rep can't sign it on their iPad. The customer has to pull their phone out and sign it there. Now I have a second barrier of entry on file. And if that's not done, we won't service the account. So there's one. Two, you need to talk to your call center, your retention department, and you need to give them some serious training on what it looks like on the doors, because they're going to get, we've tracked trends where somebody calls and says it was a one time, and realistically what it is it's another door-to-door company switching them over, telling them to say that, to get out. So you have to go in there and teach your cancellation department how to blast through those smoke screens and drive like, I'm trying to switch to a better product. And then how to resell them and re-go over your services on the phone. That's been a huge initiative that I've been undertaking there that helps drive and track true trends, okay? And then the other thing is you need to have preset non-negotiables that your Salesforce knows that, hey, if you do this, you're gone. And you're going to have to fire somebody to make an example of them, regardless of how well that guy produces. And those are the biggest things that we've seen to maintain and stay on top of compliancy.
Fantastic. What's Parker up to these days? I'm running out of time with you. I told you about an hour. We're already over that. But what are you doing today?
Oh, I'm going to get off this, and I got to go into the office for a bit. I got a couple recruiting meetings I got to run. We have some policy changes on how to schedule with an AI and an API on our termite stuff that I've got to go get some multiple platforms to talk to. We've got a negotiation with a subcontractor that we use for insulation that I've got to get on the phone with the CEO and drive integrating their portal into our portal, making that happen. And then I've got some stuff with my baby that I got to go do this evening. We got a doctor appointment my wife and I got to go run to and make happen. And then I've got some house projects when that all is done that I'm epoxying my garage floor that I'm going to have to go out there and get done.
How's the house coming along?
Good, man. We're through most of the remodel now and adding small projects here and there, and we'll redo the kitchens and bathrooms, but not this year.
That was a big project in itself.
Massive. It's been massive. And then we grabbed an Airbnb up in Fairbanks, Alaska that's going lights out, sort of managing that one right now. It's doing super well.
Is that what your future looks like? More Airbnbs that you're headed?
Oh, I don't. Yeah, I mean, I don't know if I'm going to own 100 doors. Maybe we'll see. But realistically, you make pretty good profit on Airbnb if you do the right one and two. It's a good tax strategy. It's good write-offs.
What's the next 5 years look like for you, Parker?
At some point, Hawks will sell, and I'll decide whether I cash out or I roll. It's going to depend on the new company that buys it and the offer that's in place for me and my boys. I have to get my guys a win, too, on that. Probably going to own a couple other companies. I mean, right now, like I said, we're actually doing a home efficiency company, and so probably going to drive that one and put more time and bandwidth into that. Realistically, we want to start trying for another kid here within 5 years. I would imagine we probably have three kiddos running around, staying busy doing that. So life, bro, life happens.
Yeah, it does. I love it. Cool. Well, again, Parker, thanks for everything that you've done for me in the past. And thanks for being a good friend. And also thanks for taking the last hour with us on the podcast.
Yeah. Thanks for having me on, guys. I appreciate it.
Yeah. Good chatting with you.
You too, bro.
Peace.
Peace.
Hey guys, thanks for listening to another episode of Pest Control Millionaire. We don't charge any money for the show, obviously, but the podcast isn't free. You can pay for the podcast by sharing it with your friends and your family. So please like and subscribe and give us a 5-star review on your favorite podcast app. These things make a huge difference for us. If you have any specific questions you want answered about the business or your life by me or my guest, send an email to info@pestcontrolmillionaire.com. And if you want to get in touch with me about any personal business coaching, check out our website at www.pestcontrolmillionaire.com. Thanks again for listening, and I'll see you guys again on the next one.